As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're here with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
Joining us in the studio today, it is James Restall from The Times. So coming up, we're going to look ahead to England's 1,000th international match at Wembley on Thursday. But first, let's head to Anfield. Liverpool laid down a significant marker in their bid to win a First League title in 30 years by beating the champions Manchester City 3-1 at Anfield. The roof was lifted off Anfield as early as the 6th minute when Fabinho drilled the ball past Claudio Bravo from 30 yards. But the goal was shrouded in controversy as City thought they should have had a penalty just 22 seconds earlier when the ball struck Trent Alexander-Arnold's arm in the penalty area. VAR checked the incident, deemed there was no penalty, so the goal stood to bring another huge roar from the Liverpool faithful. But let's ask both yourselves, Gregor and James, where do you stand on the Manchester City penalty shout? Obviously, Pep Guardiola believes they should have got a penalty. Do you think they should have?
Yes. I think so. I think the issue is the rules first and foremost. I think, you know, the natural silhouette, if anything, was unnatural in that silhouette. That was definitely Trent Alexander's arm in that situation. I think I can see that I feel that when the ball kind of ricocheted back off Bernardo Silva, you know, fractionally slowed down freeze frames. It happened very, very quickly, and I feel like Alexander-Arnold was really searching for Aguero. He was almost holding his arm out to sort of feel for the striker, for the opponent in the penalty area, which is something defenders naturally do. But as it was, his arm was well outside his silhouette, and the ball would have run through to Raheem Sterling with the goal at his mercy, so I think really it should have been a penalty, yes.
James, do you agree? There are a lot of people saying that the Bernardo Silva handball would have actually discounted the Trent Alexander-Arnold penalty claim because of the fact that the new law changes and everything else?
I think an incident which divides even referees. I mean, we have Bobby Madley and Mark Clattenburg on one side of the argument saying it shouldn't have been a penalty, and our own Peter Walton saying that it should have been a penalty. So I think when even the experts in the game are divided, I think really it's an issue of law and there needs to be more clarity. Personally, I think it should have been a penalty. I think if we're looking at natural silhouette, as Gregor said, I think he makes himself unnaturally bigger, and I think that should have been a spot kick.
But that, I have to say that I think that's a ludicrous law. Mm. You know, but by the law, his arm was clearly out of his body, so that I don't really see how it couldn't be given.
Well, either way, Vincent Kompany certainly was strong on it and saying, if it wasn't a penalty, then it should have been at least, the game should have at least stopped because of Bernardo Silva's handball. So you can maybe understand in both situations why Manchester City will not be happy with the outcome of that particular situation.
No, not really. I think Bernardo Silva was so quick, it was such a quick ricochet. Mm. And I think by the laws, it would have been, you know, by a free kick that it couldn't have been stopped, or certainly by VAR. So, I think, you know, as James is saying, when the experts are divided, even on the so-called experts are divided on the incident, then I think really you need to look at the way the laws have been drafted.
Well, as a result of that victory for Liverpool, they've now won 11 of their first 12 Premier League games this season, lead the table now by 8 points. Only Manchester United, back in 1993-94, have had a bigger lead after 12 games of a Premier League season, and that was 9 points. But let's focus at the moment on the champions, Manchester City. And a lot has been made of the team selection and whether or not Pep Guardiola got it right or wrong. So let's bring in the Times Manchester man Paul Hurst for more on this one and where it all went wrong for Pep Guardiola's side. Paul, when you look at the changes that Pep Guardiola made, six in total, some of course enforced as Claudio Bravo started in goal for the injured Ederson, but he has altered that back four once again, and a lot of people saying, where was Benjamin Mendy?
Yeah, I was asking that very question. I just, when I saw Angelino was playing, I just thought that's it's a big risk playing him. I think it was his second Premier League start. I mean, he's a very good player going forward, Angelino. He's a very good crosser of the ball, but defensively, I just think he lacks that kind of composure that City need in that, particularly in that kind of environment. Pep was saying on Friday that Anfield was the hardest stadium to go to in Europe at the moment. So he kind of baffled me why he didn't play Mendy. And Pep said afterwards that he felt that he couldn't play him twice in a week. But then, he played him against Atalanta, who in a match which, they could have, if they had lost against Atalanta, it wouldn't have mattered really. They'll still go through to the knockout stages. So when I saw Angelino was playing, I was a bit miffed really. I couldn't really understand that one.
Yeah, three of the back four from that draw with Atalanta were changed. John Stones picked a partner, Fernandinho, in the centre of defence, Kyle Walker, and as you say, Angelino, who was only making his second Premier League start, were the fullbacks for City. Gregor, can you make sense of these changes that Pep Guardiola made?
It's hard to make sense of, certainly at left back. But the thing I think is we're kind of... Laporte is obviously the huge miss. Mm. But otherwise, City—that's City's sort of defensive line at the moment, and I think that's been their problem right from the start of the season. Laporte's injury was a huge blow, but alongside them, John Stones has not been convincing at all. Otamendi, really, I don't think they really wanted the club much longer. Kyle Walker started the season really well. He was perhaps for the third goal a little bit at fault and wasn't his best game at the weekend, but. I just think that Manchester City's back four as a whole is a problem. Mm. And you can hide behind the fact that Laporte is injured and the goalkeeper is injured, but even where they fit, I think Manchester City's defence is the serious weak spot in this team.
Well, for all they have going forward, James, certainly the defence at Anfield at times just looked in disarray.
Well, I can help looking to the Sky studio at half-time and before the game and seeing Vincent Kompany sitting there and thinking that's what they're missing. Given the resources at Manchester City's disposal, I don't know why they didn't go and replace him in the summer. And I think, even Kompany last season, it was his amazing goal at Leicester that handed them the title. It's just they're missing everything about that man. And I think that could be the difference this season.
And Paul, maybe that is the big highlight that we should be talking about. The fact that there is no Vincent Kompany in the Manchester City team anymore. They talked about getting in a replacement. We know that they were linked to Harry Maguire, but they wouldn't stretch to the 80 million plus that Manchester United wants to pay for him.
Yeah, I mean, Pep Guardiola rarely falls out with his superiors. Obviously, he gets on very well with Chika Begiristan and Ferran Soriano and Khaldun Mubarak, the chairman. But, he was very unhappy in the summer when they didn't sign Harry Maguire. As James said, they've got so much money at City that, why not, pay the extra 10 million for Harry Maguire? They are missing a huge personality in Kompany as well as a defender. So he would have been like the perfect replacement for me. I just think as soon as Laporte got injured, I just thought that was it for City's title chances. He's such a big player for them, and to have inconsistent centre-halves in Otamendi and Stones as your only options, it just left City wide open. I think Fernandinho's probably been their best centre-back this season, which tells you everything you need to know about those options at the moment.
We'll talk more about the title race in just a moment. Interesting what you had to say on that, Paul. But I wanted to also speak about Sergio Aguero, who we know has not had a great record at Anfield. This was his ninth match there against Liverpool in all competitions. He's never scored there. And he had 14 shots without success across those nine games. He had a number of chances against Liverpool at Anfield yesterday as well, but he cannot score.
I think there's, I think there's a couple with Atletico Madrid as well. I'm sure it's 11 in all over his career. So it's an incredible stat for someone who, you know, some of those chances, the one that was flashed across the six-yard box in particular, it was almost, I don't know, he just didn't stick his leg out enough to get contact with it. And he was, just before half-time, he was sent through and dragged his shot across goal. It was a bad day for him. And seriously, there does seem to be something about him at Anfield. Well, I don't know what it is.
Well, as someone obviously that's played the game, Gregor, can you actually have a hoodoo, a jinx over you that plays on your mind?
Not in my experience. I mean, although I didn't have to play Anfield many times, I'm afraid. he was getting in the areas. I know that's a cliche, but it's kind of, there was lots of chances. I think Anfield is a bit of a hoodoo for Manchester City in general. And for Pep Guardiola, I think that, you know, he's spoken about it so much before the game about the sort of, about the atmosphere and how it's one of the most difficult places to go in the world, really. And perhaps that kind of permeates into the squad a little bit. I think, you know, as well as Manchester City played in spells, we expect them to play like that. We expect them to create chances. I still think Liverpool thoroughly deserved the win because they controlled the game for large periods and they took advantage of City's weaknesses, and that's why they deserved the win.
Well, after the game, Guardiola made a point of walking over to the referee, Michael Oliver, and his team to shake their hands, repeatedly thanking them. When asked if his thanks were genuine, he said, of course, and bizarrely insisted that his team's performance was the performance of champions. Now, Guardiola has lost 8 matches in all competitions against Klopp, 3 more than he has against any other manager. Paul, I'm sure you know him fairly well from your time in Manchester. Do you think he's beginning to crack under the pressure of facing his Liverpool foe?
I think it's just the pressure of the whole title race is definitely kind of showing on him. His touchline theatrics were even more pronounced than they usually are yesterday. The Klopp thing is something that he can't shake off, can he? He can't beat him, not really. But as Greg said, you know, the sort of curse of City playing at Liverpool is also, also important. They very rarely win at Anfield. The thing with Pep is that he's kind of showing signs of the strain a little bit. But I just think if it continues like this and they don't win Premier League this season, I still back him to be there next year, because I don't think that he'd want to leave City on a low point.
Having said that, though, should they win the Champions League, do you think he could leave after that this season?
I think, you know, if they did win the Champions League, he would have ticked every box, wouldn't he? He won every trophy that there is, and they've been longing for that trophy for so long at the club. Pochettino was on about that in the summer, that he could have left Spurs if they'd won the Champions League. But the thing is, with Pep, he has got everything that he needs at City. There's no political infighting that he had at Barcelona. There's no meddling from the owners. He's got the perfect environment to succeed. So, you know, he's got another year to go on his contract after this one. So I think he'd probably still stay. I know City certainly, you know, expect him to see out that contract. He was telling that he signed a 2-year extension rather than a 1-year extension. So, you know, it's all pointing towards him staying at the moment. So, yeah, I think that's how it'll pan out.
And Paul, to pick up on something that you mentioned a little bit earlier on, with no Laporte in the Manchester City side, you sort of suggested that the title race swung heavily in favour of Liverpool as a result of that. That's strongly what you believe. It's as simple as that, down to one man.
I think he's such a big presence, Laporte. He offers height, which City don't have in their team at all, particularly when Rodri's not playing. And he's just so good at bringing the ball out from the back. He's like an extra midfielder when he plays, Laporte. So, it was a really telling moment for me in the title race when he got injured. And just looking at the people around Pep, when Laporte got injured, they knew that was a massive blow for them. And it's one that they probably won't recover from because they didn't sign a replacement.
James, after that result then at Anfield, do you feel that the title race is over?
I don't, because I think they've still got to go to the Etihad, and you look at sort of how results can go, particularly over a busy Christmas period. We don't know how far each team's going to get in the Champions League. I mean, Liverpool have got the Club World Cup, which we were talking about last week. There are so many different factors that I still think 9 points is not enough at this stage of a gap over City. I think, you know, I don't think Liverpool will be thinking they've won it at this point. And I still think they will have to get an almighty points total, 90 plus at least, to make sure of the title this year.
Gregor, where do you stand on the title race? I mean, we sort of say it's between Liverpool and Manchester City, but the way Leicester and Chelsea are playing right now, can you dismiss them as well?
Yeah, I'm dismissing them all. It's Liverpool's.
Oh, really?
I think
done and dusted.
I think, look, I completely agree. I don't think Liverpool will think that way. I agree they've got 12 games in 5 weeks across kind of festive period. Injuries, you've got to, you know, there's a huge caveat if they were to lose, we were discussing if they were to lose a fullback who are so important for them, or Van Dijk. Mm-hmm. I still think they would cope better than Manchester City have, because they've got these, I think they've got more kind of depth to their squad. But I think, I just can't see Liverpool losing. Maybe it would probably have to be, you know, 4 or 5 games between now and the end of the season, and Manchester City being almost kind of perfect. I can't see that happening. So I think really it's done. They're so much better than everyone else in the league.
Leicester laid down a significant marker in the race to finish in the Premier League's top four by beating Arsenal 2-0 to move 9 points ahead of sixth place Gunners. Jamie Vardy broke the deadlock in the 68th minute with his 9th goal in as many games against the Gunners, finishing a slick Leicester move involving Yuri Tielemans and Harvey Barnes. James Maddison then secured Leicester's win 7 minutes later with a fine strike into the bottom corner to send the Foxes second in the table. The defeat increases the heat, of course, on under fire Arsenal head coach Unai Emery, whose position at the Emirates has come under intense pressure in recent weeks. They're down to sixth then in the table, 8 points behind fourth place right now, and they are without a win in their last 4 Premier League matches. So the speculation continues over the position of Unai Emery. James, should we actually be speculating over his future, or should we be thinking it's just a dip right now?
Well, Tony Cascarino in his game column this morning has said it's a one-game situation for Emery now. He thinks defeat against Southampton after the international break, and that should be curtains.
Right.
And I can understand why he's come to that conclusion, because, I mean, that performance at Leicester was awful. I mean, you've got Aubameyang and Lacazette, two incredible forwards who, on their day, are probably some of the best forwards in the Premier League, operating effectively as wing-backs. Mm. And you've got, you know, at times you would see a flat back Arsenal 5 defence, the midfield in front, and just sitting off Leicester, not putting them under any pressure, and basically saying, you know, they were hanging in there for an hour before Leicester scored. Mm-hmm. So I can see why people are calling for change at Arsenal.
His position is being questioned more and more, partly down to the tactics that everyone just bemuses over. No one can quite understand what Arsenal we're seeing week in, week out, Gregor.
What Arsenal are. I think, you know, they've been kind of shown up on a number of occasions now, and that Leicester team and the effect Brendan Rodgers has had on them was one instance that's kind of pretty damning of Unai Emery and his tactics and his imprint on the team. You know, I completely agree. There's a heat map in the game today of Arsenal, and they were, you know, Leicester played almost entirely in Arsenal's half. And I know Arsenal are having a tough time of it, but to kind of sit off and be so sort of submissive was very peculiar. And I agree, having the most outstanding attacking talents in the Premier League operating as fullback is bizarre. So I think he's fortunate in that the next games have got Southampton, Norwich, Brighton, West Ham, and then you've got Manchester City, Everton, Chelsea, Manchester United. So that kind of block of games that's coming up are going to be key for him. And, you know, I think all the noises emanating from the Emirates are saying that they want to give him the season. They want to stick with him. But I think if he was to lose the next couple, the next three games even, or just not get any points out of those next four games, I think he should go anyway, really. I think he's failed. I think it was always going to be a tough job to replace Arsene Wenger, but I think there's no evidence that they've improved, and I think really it's going to be a pretty toxic place for the remainder of the season. And I think it could almost be a case of they just kind of continue for the rest of the season because they don't want to make a sort of knee-jerk reaction unless it gets so bad, and then they just part company in the summer.
Well, their record of 17 points and a minus one goal difference is their worst ever start to a Premier League season after 12 games. James, can we have any sympathy for Emery in the sense that do you feel his hands may well have been tied in the transfer market, for example, and that the players that were already at Arsenal simply weren't good enough anyway?
I think so, but if you look at the business they did do, they spent a record $72 million on Nicolas Pepe, and he's not exactly shown, or he's not exactly been the player I think Arsenal fans were expecting him to be. A couple of brilliant free kicks in the Europa League aside. And also, you know, there's big question marks over David Luiz as a defender as well. You know, he's not kind of, you know, he does have an error in him. He's played very well for Chelsea over the years, but you know, if you're looking to fix a defence, I don't know necessarily whether David Luiz would be the right player. So I think in terms of the recruitment that they have done, I don't know how successful that has been, really.
Well, as it is, it was Leicester that won that game, and Brendan Rodgers' side's haul of 26 points from their 12 Premier League games this season is the most ever at this stage of a top-flight campaign. That's one more than they had in their title-winning season of 2015-16. Brendan Rodgers insists he is loving it at Leicester, despite calls for him to replace Unai Emery at Arsenal. After the win, Rodgers also suggested that he never received the necessary financial backing at Liverpool to go on and win the league. He said this: "At Liverpool, of course, we were very good going forward. You have to ask, did I have the players to defend how we'd want to defend? I think now at Liverpool, they obviously invest a lot of money to get those types of players in." So that's him speaking about his time at Liverpool. But with regards to how well Leicester are doing under Brendan Rodgers, first of all, let's just ask, how has he changed things from when Claude Puel was there?
I mean, dramatically in every department. I think speaking to Leicester players, they've just been absolutely blown away by the level of detail of his training. And, you know, it bore fruit almost immediately. I think they play like more than 100 passes more per game than under Claude Puel. The pressing, the intensity of their game, you saw that against Southampton. You know, they were going 4 and 5 nil up, and he was still on the touchline, you know, cajoling them and saying, "Close down." It's like as soon as they lose the ball, they've got to hound to get it back. And it's such stark contrast to Arsenal, and you see them sort of players ambling back or not closing down, and some of the goals they've conceded have been, you know, kind of teams have just cut through them with ease. So it's both sides of the game. I think there's a real, you know, kind of real uplift in the level of intensity of their training, and that's transferred to a match day, and the whole overall style of play has been transformed. They're possession dominant, and the first goal was kind of trademark Leicester now already, from Ricardo, and the, you know, the little combination between Harvey Barnes, a little flick to Tielemans, and he squared it for Vardy, and Vardy scored. We've seen a few of those goals already this season, and I think we'll see a lot more of them. It's those sort of combinations in and around the penalty box, and they've got talent, players that are talented enough to do that.
Gregor's already said that the title race is done and dusted, James, but do you think Leicester can really shake things up?
I think they're a fearless team, and they will give it a go against any opposition, and they will be effective against a lot of opponents. In terms of whether they're going to really challenge for the title, I think the top four is a more realistic ambition. I'd also love to see them win one of the domestic cups. I think the top four is a more realistic ambition for Leicester this season. It'd be great to see them win one of the domestic cups mm-hmm. this season, and I think that's also a realistic objective. But yeah, I think they're one of the most exciting teams this season, and the top four should be their aim now.
Is that the same for you then, Gregor? Top four for Leicester?
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, obviously they've been helped by the sort of turmoil at Manchester United and Tottenham and Arsenal, but they look like a better side than all three of those teams at the moment, essentially. And it's going well. I'm sure there'll be troubles for them. There'll be times where if they lose if they were to lose Vardy per se, although he's got a great injury record, if they were to lose Maddison or Tielemans, but they've got, you know, really kind of a young, hungry team that is determined to sort of better themselves. And I think there is also something about since the kind of tragedy of of Kumbuchai's death, I think there is a real determination to win a trophy as well. It's, you know, you look at the team selections they've made for domestic cups, I think there is a determination to win a trophy and to sort of honour him with. So I think it's very positive times for Leicester, and I think actually beyond the season they'll be struggling to hold on to Brendan Rodgers.
Just finally on Leicester though, inevitably as they progress and do so well as they are, won't they have a fight to keep hold of Brendan Rodgers?
I think so, but I think if they do reach the top four and they are in the Champions League then next season, then I think that's reason enough for him to stay at least another season and see how far he can get them in Europe. Equally, if they win the FA Cup, say, you know, I think that's every reason for him to stay.
I agree, because he's, you know, there was a big fallout with with Celtic and his departure there, and I don't think it would do his sort of image any favours if he was to walk out in Leicester within the space of a year or so. I think he's determined to kind of stay and build something there, but I think there will be suitors because, as we're seeing, his impact on the team has been remarkable.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Sheffield United overcame VAR controversy to grab a 1-1 draw at Tottenham after having a goal ruled out for John Lundstrom's big toe being offside. Despite being second best for the majority, Spurs took the lead through Heung-min Son, but the Blades thought they had equalised when David McGoldrick struck 2 minutes later. However, after a four-minute wait at the centre circle, VAR overturned the goal as it was deemed Lundstrom's big toe was offside in the build-up. Chris Wilder's men were right to feel hard done by, but remained the more creative team and found a way through when George Baldock's cross from the right flew straight in, as Spurs just couldn't match United's intensity and willingness to press in midfield. It has been such an impressive campaign for Sheffield United so far, flying high of the promoted teams. How high do you think Sheffield United could finish, Gregor? As someone who knows Chris Wilder well.
I mean, it's a difficult question. I think the top half is definitely attainable for them. But I just think with, you know, there's a lot going on in the Premier League just now, but there's definitely worthy of mention. It's remarkable that they're fifth. They've not lost away from home in the first season in the Premier League. I don't think they've lost. There was a good start from Bill, actually, in the paper today. They've not lost away from home in a year in England. They did lose against Swansea City, but they're Welsh, obviously. and they've not lost by more than one goal for 60 games, which is remarkable. So I think, you know, we've spoken about the impact that Brendan Rodgers has had on Leicester, the impact that and the sort of identity of Liverpool and under Jurgen Klopp, and the same can be said of Manchester City, of course. But the same equally is true of Sheffield United. And I think it's also quite instructive to see how supporters of teams, you know, when they beat Arsenal 1-0 at Bramall Lane, the Sheffield United were showered with praise, but there was also a bit of kind of fun being poked at Arsenal. And then they go to Tottenham, and, you know, every Tottenham Hotspur fan I know, as staunch a supporter as they may be, they said Sheffield United were the better team. And it's like everywhere they go, they're sort of impressing, they're having an impression on opposition fans, and they're not really kind of understanding how well organised and well coached and well drilled this team is until they kind of see it for themselves firsthand. And I think that's going to continue throughout the season. Their team is, you know, it's the same every single week. You can name it from 1 to 11, apart from perhaps a striker. Mm-hmm. That's about the only change they ever make. And they're such a kind of well-organised, well-drilled team that are so solid defensively, but when they need to, they flood players forward in attack. And they're really, really hard to beat.
But that is what's so unique about them. They have a unique brand, a unique style about Sheffield United that we're seeing in the Premier League, James.
My first recollections of Chris Wilder was covering Northampton in, I think, 2015-16. And they were top of League Two. But there were financial problems at the club. The players hadn't been paid for weeks, if not months. And yet, this was a team that were playing high intensity, attacking football every week. They were on their way to setting, I think, record points totals. And Chris Wilder was the man motivating these players who weren't being paid through this, what must have been a very, very difficult time for the club. And, you know, there were fans outside rattling buckets trying to save the club while the team were doing remarkable things on the pitch. So while I'm surprised that Sheffield United are fifth in the table, I'm not surprised that we're seeing these performances with Sheffield United, because this is a manager, everywhere he's gone, it seems to be the ultimate motivator.
There's been some really, you know, there has been one or two lazy assessments of Sheffield United so far this season about them being kind of long ball merchants. And, you know, even much as I love James Gerbrandt, his column last week about, you know, he's comparing Sean Dyche and Chris Wilder. Brilliant column, because it kind of articulated the earthy values of these two guys and their sort of impact on their two teams and the clubs. But there was one line that was saying it was kind of a game that's more likely to be played in the air above Bramall Lane than on the pitch. Go and watch Sheffield United. That's not true. You might be, you know, near the top of the statistics for long balls, but when they get the ball down and play, they pass it with pace and purpose. And, you know, I think they're a joy to watch at times.
In the game today, the Times' Bill Edgar has crunched the numbers on Tottenham's poor run and believes they're too reliant on Harry Kane. Here's Bill with more.
I've had a look at how Maurizio Pochettino uses substitutions when his Tottenham side are trailing in a match, because it felt as though Harry Kane is never chosen to make way. So to see if that was true, I looked back at Tottenham's matches from the summer of 2014 onwards, which is about the time Kane leapt to prominence, and found that, aside from two occasions when he was injured or lacking fitness after a long-term injury, he had never been taken off by Pochettino when the team were behind. Of the 54 games in which Kane has been substituted in this period, Spurs were winning in 50 and drawing the other four, and those four matches were fixtures where Spurs would probably have been happy with a draw. Yet Tottenham's other leading attacking players have been substituted many times uninjured when the team have been losing during that period. Christian Eriksen 9 times, Eric Lamella and Dele Alli 13 times each, and Son Heung-min 19 times. So for more than 5 years now, Kane has clearly been seen as indispensable.
The Times' Bill Edgar there with some number crunching on Spurs' poor run in the Premier League. But do we think it is all down to over-reliance on Kane? What do we think?
I think they are over-reliant on Harry Kane. He has that knack of being able to get you a goal whenever. And I think, you know, he's not been in the best form this season, but his goal tally is still fairly strong. I almost don't blame Pochettino for not taking him off. Why would you? If you need a goal, he's your man. But it does suggest an over-reliance, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's their talisman. There's one caveat with, you know, remember James Gerbrandt writing some really interesting pieces about the times when he's been injured, when Kane's been injured, and it almost seems like Tottenham, as a kind of collective and an attacking unit, sometimes play better. And I find that very interesting. But the thing is, Kane just keeps coming up with moments. He can create his own goals, and he's, you know, he rarely misses when he's given an opportunity. So he is their talisman, and it's not surprising at all that they don't want to take him off the pitch.
It is time now to look back on the EFL. And this weekend, Gregor, you've been to high-flying Preston. They ended Huddersfield's seven-match unbeaten run with a comfortable win. Is that right, at Deepdale?
Yeah, very comfortable. They were flew out the blocks, 3-1 victory. There were two up within half an hour. Paul Gallagher scored a third early in the second half. Huddersfield rallied towards the end, but Preston looked solid. And I think really, you know, having just spoken about Chris Wilder and Sheffield United, I don't want to go overboard about this, but there are some parallels in the fact, well, they're a kind of a similar club in that they're a, you know, club with rich history in the north, who have been almost kind of feel like they've been left behind a little bit by the modern game. Their match day and commercial revenues are among the lowest in the league. They've got one of the smallest budgets. I think their wage bill is 15 million. They've got a squad that's kind of made up of players from the lower leagues that they've paid maybe a few hundred thousand pounds for. I think their record signing was Tom Bayliss from Coventry City for a couple of million in the summer. But before that, it was like 2001 for David Healy from Manchester United. So it shows the kind of very kind of frugal journey they've been on. They've been in League One. And in Alex Neil, they've got someone who's kind of no-nonsense, says it how it is, straight talker. And also, tactically intelligent, very kind of a good coach and a good manager and a motivator. And watching them, they were really, from the first whistle, they were up and at Huddersfield and they could not cope with them. And I drew some parallels in my column today with what's happened at Sheffield United, because I don't think anyone really took Sheffield United seriously last year. There was so much talk about Leeds United under Marcelo Bielsa, about Aston Villa even, when they were kind of surging up through the division after Dean Smith took over. You know, bigger clubs, more vaunted names in the dugout, on the team badge, even on the team sheet. Clubs with far higher wage bills, you know. And I don't think anyone really believed until the death that Sheffield United were going to do what they did. And I think the Championship could well do the same with Preston North End this year. They've been quite close in the last couple of years. They've had the same team for a couple of seasons, again, which is similar to Sheffield United. They know each other inside out, the way their strengths and weaknesses, the way they play. They're well drilled, highly motivated, and I think they've got a chance this season.
England's Euro 2020 qualifier at Wembley on Thursday against Montenegro will see them reach 1,000 senior men's internationals. And James, you've been putting together Times' coverage ahead of this monumental match on Thursday. What can we expect?
We've got lots of things lined up for this amazing milestone that the England national team have reached. Kicking off today, Matt Dickinson has interviewed Viv Anderson and Alan Mullery. Two former England players who are significant for very different reasons. Viv Anderson was the first black men's senior international, and he talks about racism in football from over the last 40 years, how much has changed and how much hasn't, how much improvement there has been in tackling these issues. Alan Mullery was the first England player to be sent off. Alan Mullery talks about his grandson seeing that clip for the first time. So there are lots of things like that we've got planned. And if anybody hasn't read it so far, I would I'd urge them to read Matt's column from last week with Bert Mosley, who Bert was, very sadly, until a couple of weeks ago, the oldest living England international. He sadly passed away in Canada, where he lived, aged 96. Matt had tracked him down and had planned to speak to him for an interview for this piece. It's a very emotional read, and I'd urge everyone to read it.
Yeah, it's a beautiful piece, and I agree with you. You should read it, certainly. And it was more about how they didn't realise the significance of him and the fact that he was still alive at the time of when Matt tried to get in touch with them. It is a beautiful piece, so please do read it. Harry Kane has been speaking ahead of the showpiece event at Wembley. He has selected England's 5-1 win in Germany back in 2001 as his favourite ever England game. James, do you agree with that one?
The 5-1 in Germany is certainly the first England match I remember watching the full 90 minutes of. I was in a holiday cottage with my mum, my dad, my brother, aunt, uncle and my nan. And we were sitting there eating fish and chips beforehand on a tiny little TV. And we did a sweepstake and my nan picked 0-0. And so that was good fun. I think she left very quickly after Carsten Janka scored. My own personal favourite, and it's not just because Gregor's sitting here. My own personal favourite, bizarrely, it's as amazing as our penalty, as amazing as the penalty shootout win at the World Cup was, and reaching the semi-finals. For me, it was when Ricky Lambert scored against Scotland. The reason being, as a Leighton Orient fan myself, I'd seen Ricky Lambert terrorise Leighton Orient defenders at Rochdale, at Stockport, at Bristol Rovers and at Southampton, and to see him come off the bench and score the winner for England, I thought it was just the most amazing story, and it was great to see his journey sort of reach that pinnacle.
I was at that game actually. I was trying to think. I was trying to think the first England game, maybe the only England game I've been at. I think Scotland took the lead twice as well on that one.
I think it stands in your mind because it was such a poignant moment for Ricky Lambert.
Of course, yes. No, actually, that was an amazing journey for Ricky Lambert. Yeah. I think it was the first time that the two countries had played in about 14 years as well, so that was quite a memorable game. But there's not been many other memorable games, England games for me, I'm afraid, because usually it involves Scotland playing and us losing.
Well, I mean, I do like the 5-1 win, I have to say, that Harry Kane opted for. I'm a bit older than you, James. So I remember I was at university and we watched it at home, the girls, and we enjoyed it so much. Obviously, the euphoria that led after that. We obviously had to go straight out, didn't we? Had to go to the pub for celebratory drinks. So that was a good night. In the game today, England's greatest 11 is being compiled, starting with the goalkeeper. So if we're doing that, and we're picking England's greatest ever goalkeeper, who do we opt for in there?
It's a difficult one if you're only picking players who you've seen, because on those grounds, I'd probably have to go for David Seaman, as I think Matt Lawton picked. But I think looking over the piece and over the 1,000 games, you can't look past Gordon Banks. I mean, when Gordon sadly passed away recently, that save was replayed again and again and again.
The Pele save,
mm-hmm. and it was analysed kind of in the way that we now analyse football, and looking at it from as many angles as we can, and reaction times, and it's a remarkable iconic moment. And you know, the fact that that actually came in an England defeat as well, and the fact that we still talk about that save, and as a World Cup winner, I'd have to go for Gordon Banks.
I think that the reason we talk about it more and more as well, but because Pele actually, he strongly thought it was in. It was a goal.
Yeah.
No one could save it. Yeah, it was a tremendous save by Gordon Banks. I'm sure you're loving this conversation we're having, Gregor, but if we could ask you to pick who you would say would be England's best number one ever?
Well, I mean, that save is kind of seared in my memory too. I had a VHS video of kind of World Cups as a kid, and that was a moment that I remember very clearly. But Peter Shilton as well, I think, you know, he was a huge figure at Nottingham Forest where I started out. Obviously won the European Cup there. And he was kind of spoken of as a professional, a real professional in a time when players weren't professional, if you know what I mean. And that's the only, you know, that's the reason why he's had such a haul of caps and I think a record number of appearances as well. I think Peter Shilton was a kind of huge figure and a kind of iconic England goalkeeper as well. So, well, I didn't see him live. He's someone whose impact I kind of was aware of coming through as a young pro.
Do you think England are in good hands right now, James, under Gareth Southgate?
Absolutely. There have been a couple of setbacks recently. The Czech Republic result wasn't brilliant. The Nations League semi-final against Holland exposed the flaws, or perhaps the unpreparedness of the team to play out from the back under pressure. But I think when you look at England under Gareth Southgate, I think you've got to look to that result against Spain in the Nations League group stage, and that was the night everything clicked, and England were, that was England getting people out of their seats and getting people excited. And
going 3-0 up against Spain, that's a result, or that was a moment in a match that I probably wouldn't have seen happening even 2 years ago when we were crashing out to Iceland. So I think England are under a good place. I love the way that he's bringing in young players, and he's recognising the players in form, giving them call ups, getting them in the team, getting them around, in and around the squad. So I think England are in a very good place.
Just on that point, and maybe Gregor, you can help us out on this. You mentioned he's bringing in young players. We're still waiting for Jack Grealish to get the nod. Fabian Delph, obviously, has been brought in. And in a way, Southgate has received criticism for the fact that he's left out Grealish and brought in Delph. What does the Aston Villa man have to do to get into this England squad?
Well, I think he was left out of the derby at the weekend, so he's obviously had a bit of an injury, which hasn't helped him on this occasion. But I don't know, I feel like there's a risk of him being someone like a kind of Letizia, and that there's something that's perhaps missing in Gareth Southgate's eye, and maybe it's dynamism. You know, he's an unusual player. He's kind of very elegant. He strolls around the pitch. He can beat players without being particularly quick. And he actually covers more distance than any other Aston Villa player in most games, which is, you wouldn't think when you're at a game watching him live. But he's hugely talented. And I'd be surprised if he's not capped. But it's also a position that he has a lot of competition in just now. You know, we've spoken about James Maddison can't get a cap just now, and he's been in great form. So I think he will be capped. I'm not sure if in the kind of very elite echelons of the modern game, where everything is about pace and dynamism and power, he's going to fit into that mould.
Well, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, James Restall and Paul Hurst.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. And we'll be back on Thursday.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.